from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, in his new book, Our Kids, Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam looks at how income inequality is creating an opportunity gap that puts the American dream out of reach for many families. Putnam uses examples from his hometown of Port Clinton, Ohio, and also examples from communities throughout the United States to illustrate the challenges of rising out of poverty. Author of the influential 2000 book, Bowling Alone, he joins us in the studio, and that's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. One of the nation's leading social scientists, Robert Putnam, is professor of public policy at Harvard and former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also the author of Bowling Alone and American Grace and a recipient of the National Humanities Medal, as well as being a member of the National Academy of Sciences and a fellow of the British Academy. His newest book centers on the growing gap between poor and rich children in the United States. It's titled Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis. And presently, one in five American children live below the poverty line. We discuss what that's all about and the gap between rich and poor with our guest, Robert Putnam, this hour, who joins us here in studio. And good to have you back here, Bob. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, I just have to begin by telling my listeners that the Sunday Times of London called you the most influential academic in the world. Boy, heavy is the head that wears that crown. I don't know how you get to that title.
It's made me very popular with all my colleagues.
Yeah, I'm sure. A lot of schadenfreude on that one. But I want to get right into your book here because I think it's a very important book. It's really a moral call, as some have described it. And what we're talking about are compelling stories which just point out something that certainly many of us realize. Maybe this generation, this younger millennial generation and those succeeding them are not going to do as well as their parents, but even the generation before the millennials are not. There's this growing gap, and it is a growing gap between rich and poor children.
Yes, that's the part that startled me. I'm focused on the fact of the growing inequality of opportunity, what we call the opportunity gap between rich kids and poor kids. Rich kids, by rich kids, I don't mean Bill Gates's kids. I mean just people coming from the upper third of American society, that basically those are college-educated Americans. And kids coming from college-educated homes are doing better than ever on many different measures, on test scores, on involvement in extracurricular activities, and on time and money that their parents spend on them, and many other measures. But on those same measures, kids coming from the lower third of American society, that is kids coming from high school-educated homes of all races, kids coming from high school-educated homes are going down, not up. And that produces in this book a whole series of the what we call scissors graphs, in which the upper blade of the scissors is representing kids coming from affluent homes, my grandchildren, and they're doing better than ever. But kids coming from the other side of the tracks are doing worse and worse. That gap directly violates what I think is the core value in America, which is that everybody ought to get a decent, fair start in life. How well you do in life shouldn't depend upon what your parents did or didn't do. It should depend upon your own, you know, God-given talents and grit and hard work, but it shouldn't depend on something else that you had no control over, namely your parents.
Well, but it does. I mean, the evidence is there. And one of the most, I think, perhaps compelling things is when you say essentially, you know, rich kids, again, we're not talking about Gates kids here, but rich kids who are not necessarily of great intelligence can have a better opportunity to get a college education than poor kids who are of better intelligence and higher intelligence.
It was a stunning there's a stunning chart in the book which shows exactly that kids who score in their eighth grade test scores are in the lower quartile. Let's not call them dumb. Let's call them not good on test scores.
Lower achievers.
But whose parents are wealthy are more likely to graduate from college than kids who score in the top quartile. That is the really hardworking, intelligent kids, but whose parents are from the bottom third of the economic hierarchy. And that just fundamentally says merit doesn't matter as much as parental background. And that, it's hard for me to reconcile that with the basic values of American society.
Well, it has a lot of nuances to it. And let's look at some of those. I mean, on the one hand, we've had, you go back to your hometown of Port Clinton, Ohio, and you realize manufacturing is pretty much gone. So kids are going downhill, and it has a lot to do with the shops that are being closed and the nature of
Some kids are going down.
A lot of the kids are going. But there's a lack of, you talk about lack of social supports, and you talk about, especially for the low-income children, fairly poor quality schools and all of those things, but also things that maybe listeners don't know or don't think about in terms of the terminology or the lexicon you use, like airbags. Let's talk about airbags.
Well, look, I begin with the premise that all kids do dumb things. Rich kids, poor kids, black kids, brown kids, white kids, your kids, my kids, all kids do dumb things. When a kid coming from an affluent home does something dumb, they drink too much, or they get involved with drugs, or they make a bad romantic decision, or they have a fight with a teacher, or they wreck the family car. Instantly, airbags inflate to protect them. I give a very practical example from my own life. Just a couple of weeks ago, a friend of ours called to say that his grandson, away at college, had been picked up by the police for some drug offense, maybe even dealing drugs. And the grandparents were worried about it, of course. And we were, these are friends, so we were sympathizing with them, saying how's the family doing? That's too bad, blah blah blah. And he's responded, yeah, it is bad, of course, but we've got the best lawyer in town on the case, and we've found the best rehab facility in the state, and our grandson is now in that rehab facility. And I turned to my wife and I said, airbags. I'm not blaming them for that. I would do the same thing with my own grandchild. But what you have to recognize is that poor kids in America, unlike in the past, are now remarkably isolated from all sources of social support. So when they do a dumb thing, no airbags. They have no. If they can't learn from their mistakes, they're ruined by their mistakes.
And you use the word isolation, and the thing that's also particularly of concern here is how isolated poor kids become. I mean, in many cases, you're talking about one-parent homes, college-educated homes and stable family versus a one-parent home, which is often parents that don't get their one parent who hasn't gotten through high school and so forth. And so you talk about goodnight moon time. I mean, this is a real phenomenon. People don't have the time necessarily that the affluent folks have who are educated, sit down with their kids and read to them and do those sorts of things and pay attention to them, essentially.
That is another example of the growing gap. We know from the data that 30 years ago there was no class gap in what we're called goodnight moon time, which is just my label for the time that parents spend reading to their kids.
That's where I may quibble with you. There was a class gap, not necessarily in the context you're talking about. But I can remember growing up working class and thinking, why do these kids have cars and I don't have a car?
No, there was no class gap in the amount of time working class parents.
We're talking in that context. Okay, yeah.
No class gap in the amount of time that working class parents or middle class parents spent with their kids. There was no gap. There were, of course, other gaps. I'm not saying there were no other gaps. But there was no gap in goodnight moon time. And now there is a 45-minute-a-day gap in the amount of time that affluent parents are able to spend reading to their kids compared to working-class parents. And for a lot of reasons. But the fact is we now know that from the most recent brain science that that's not just a risible, a funny little difference. That is powerfully influential on the brain development of kids, because we now know that the brain does not develop, the infant brain does not develop like a mushroom in a dark room just autonomously growing. The human brain is programmed to develop through social interaction. The baby says goo-goo, and the adult says ah, and the baby says goo-goo, and the adult says ah. And that interaction produces brain growth. And in the absence of that kind of interaction, in the absence of goodnight moon time, the infant brain is not nearly so stimulated. So this is not just, jokey stuff about goodnight moon. It powerfully influences the fact that when the gap, the test score gap between rich kids and poor kids, that is also growing, as Sean Reardon down at Stanford has shown, that gap is as wide as it's ever going to get before kids even get to school. So these differences, these growing class differences, have deep roots.
And the deepest root of it all may be the decimation of the working class as
yes.
we knew it and as it was constituted. I mean, you could live in a lower middle class neighborhood and you could essentially aspire up and be socially mobile. And now that's become increasingly, as you point out in your book and as you give the evidence and many of the stories that are quite compelling for, it's no longer the case.
Right.
It's also striking to read about some of these stories that you really make personal and make us understand. I mean, and I wonder where we see race in all this particularly. I mean, for example, there's a story you tell about these two Latina girls who live in Orange, California, and they're like just about 15 minutes away from each other. But
right.
the chasm, the difference is stark.
Yeah. The, one of the and as you know, in each of the chapters of the book, we begin by looking at just two families of the same race and in the same town or city or metropolitan area, but from different economic backgrounds. So that's the comparison we're doing. And in this case, the upper-class family, these are both second-generation Latino families. One has been very successful, and they've moved to an affluent part of Orange County, and their kids go to Troy High School, which is one of the best high schools, not just in California, but one of the best high schools in America, 15 minutes away in Santa Ana. Another family, it's not even quite right to call it a family because the kids and the family, the parents were frankly disasters. They were involved in drug activity and gang activity. The kids were raised for part of the time by their grandparents. And the school they go to is dominated by gang violence. And these kids, these two Latina girls in Santa Ana, are living in a different universe from the kids in the upper-class Latina family just 10, 15 miles away. That there is, of course, I'm back to the question of race that you're raising. That story that I just told illustrates that there are growing class gaps within each of the major racial groups in America. There are growing class gaps among blacks, among Latinos, and especially among whites. The growth of the class gap is actually greatest among whites between affluent and impoverished white families. But of course, in addition to that, there are just purely racial differences. And the book focuses mostly on the class differences that are, I think, really important. But there are also just purely racial differences that we can't lose sight of, that there are.
That account for poverty and especially interurban difficulties
and
that can't be.
Yeah, and that go back deep into our own national history, of course. So I want to try to say about race and class in this book two things. One is there are still racial injustices in America. But there are growing class injustices, and those put a double burden on poor minority kids. That is, they're facing challenges because of their race, but they're also facing increasingly challenges because of their poverty. And the latter difficulties they share with white kids or with people of other races who are also poor.
We're, by the way, talking to Robert Putnam, professor of public policy at Harvard, whose new book is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. And the title is arresting because you're also working with a thread of an idea here that there's less civic engagement, less concern. You know, it takes a village type of attitude that we have to care for all of our children. We have to be concerned about all of our children, including the poor children from the affluent status.
When I was growing up in Port Clinton, Ohio, and that's the story that begins the book, Port Clinton was not an ideal place. This was the 1950s, so there was racism and racism and sexism. But in class terms, Port Clinton was remarkably homogeneous and remarkably equal. So 80% of the kids in my graduating class did better than their parents. This is the graduating class of 1959. 80% did better than their parents, and the kids from the wrong side of the tracks did just about as well as the kids from the right side of the tracks. So it was, in class terms, it was a pretty remarkable place. And part of that was because when my parents or other adults at the time said, we've got to do things for our kids. We've got to pay higher taxes so our kids can have a new swimming pool, or we need a French department in the school, so let's have a bond issue so we can pay, you know, so we can afford, the schools can afford a French instruction for all the kids in town. When they said that, they did not mean our kids. They did not mean my sister and me. They meant all the kids in town. And over the course of the last generation or two, what's happened across America is that the meaning of our kids has shriveled. So now when people talk about we're doing things for our kids, they mean their biological kids. And the poor kids in Port Clinton and there are a lot of now, increasingly numbers of really very poor kids in Portland because of the Rust Belt phenomenon you talked about. The more affluent people in Portland say, those are not our kids. I mean, you know, they're somebody else's kids. Let them worry about them. And that change in the meaning of our kids is what lies behind the book. I do think there's been there are a lot of changes, economic changes and cultural changes.
But you're
changes.
Talking about a diminution of civic responsibility.
I am. I'm talking about a diminution of our sense that we're all in this together and that we all have an interest, which we do objectively. We all objectively have an interest in all these kids. My grandchildren's lives, my grandchildren are going to do fine because they're coming from an affluent homes, but their lives are going to be poorer because we're not investing enough in poor kids. We're going to pay a big price. I mean, a big financial price.
Yeah, in fact, I've seen those figures. You're talking about lower labor productivity, and you're talking about jail and public health, and it comes out to $500 billion a year.
Over the course of the lives of these kids, their lives, the best estimate is $5 trillion it's costing.
Over the cost of their lives, yeah.
And that's real money we're talking about.
Real money. Yeah. Eric Durkin, you say, well, it's billions and billions, but now we're talking trillions, right? And we're talking again with
Robert
Putnam.
Well, it's a joke, but the point I want to make is this is not a zero-sum game. It's not as if we were helping more of these kids coming from poor backgrounds would hurt my kids. My kids would live in a richer America if we would invest more in other people's kids, too.
Well, you were at Georgetown. There was a poverty summit that President Obama was involved in, and so was the president at Georgetown, our friend E.J. Dionne. I mean, it was a major summit, and President Obama said this is what he wants his legacy to be, bridging a gap between this kind of chasm that we're talking about between rich and poor. And even recently, Jeb Bush said this is the dividing issue of our time. And you've talked to a lot of the leading candidates, and they seem concerned. But what really can government do? I mean, I raise that question because you have people like, for example, I know President Obama cares about this, but you have people like Cornel West, your former colleague, because of Larry Summers now at Princeton, and my colleague, Tavis Smiley, who are saying the president is not doing enough. And then there's this great polarization between, I think President Obama mentioned it at that summit. He said there are those of the libertarians who say, oh, they're just moochers. We can't help them. We can't provide a bigger social net. I've read Ayn Rand, and he said, on the other hand, you know, we have people who say we have to keep pouring in more money. But government seems paralyzed on this.
Well, not only on this issue. I mean, government's paralyzed on every issue,
agreed,
Michael. I mean, I don't think it's particularly this issue. Look, when we began this project 5 years ago, the aspiration of my research team and me was to try to help contribute to making this issue, the growing opportunity gap between rich kids and poor kids in America, the central domestic issue in the presidential election of 2016. And I think it's turning out that's likely to happen. I don't say it's because of our project, but I do think we've contributed to this growing sense that there's a problem here. And as you say, Jeb Bush, Paul Ryan,
Hillary Clinton, too.
Well, of course. Yeah. And so we're going to be debating it. I've never thought that if we had it as a central issue of debate, everyone's going to agree. Of course not. There's going to be differing opinions, and that's what elections are about, people sharing. If we agree on what the problem is, what's your idea for fixing it, Jeb, or what's your idea for fixing it, Hillary, or whoever the candidate is? But, and this is the most important political strategic point, if you look at how social reform occurs in America, if you go back to the most similar period in our history, which was the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, which was very, very much like our plight now. That was called the Gilded Age. That was also a period of great economic contrasts, a period of high immigration and unease in the country because of immigration, a period of great political deadlock and enormous political corruption, and a period in which the dominant public philosophy was what was then called social Darwinism. Social Darwinism amounted to saying we're all better off if we're just selfish, if you look out for number one and the devil take the hindmost. There are certain parallels between that philosophy and our current public debate. And then, so the period was very much like ours. And then in a pretty short period of time, the problem got fixed in the sense that a lot of major reforms, child labor laws and minimum wage requirements and most importantly of all, free public secondary education. The high school was invented by American reformers at that period to try to level the playing field. And those innovations did not come from Washington or did not come from Cambridge, Mass. Or from the Bay Area. Where they came from was small towns all across America, Toledo and Galveston and small towns in Iowa and Kansas – The national debate at that period, what we know about the Progressive Era, the national debate was Jane Addams and Teddy Roosevelt and so on, helped give oxygen to local reformers all across the country. But the innovations came from those people working to try to fix this problem in Sacramento or in Toledo or in Galveston. And the national reforms, the national political response to that was a lagging indicator, came after all of these real
reforms. More local, yeah.
And that's what I think could happen right now. I think we will have a national election, but I never thought that we were going to have then on, you know, February 1st of 2017, the Congress would pass a bill saying there shall be equal opportunity in America and spending a lot of money on it, and we could, you know, dust our hands off and say, well, we solved that problem. Now let's see if we can get to work on global warming. That's not the way we do social reform in America. We do it in this bottom-up but encouraged by the national discussion. And I think that could very well happen this time. That's what I'm working hard with. I've been working with lots of local groups all across this country to try to replicate that example of serious social reform.
I think that's a good paradigm to think about, although I'm also thinking about your last book because the churches play a really significant role in terms of ameliorating poverty, especially the Catholic Church.
Well, as you remember, Michael, because we talked about it when at the time we published the earlier book, American Grace, the evidence shows religious people are more generous with their time and with their money to poor people than comparable non-religious people. So we got to give a gold star to religious people and religious organizations for spending money on the issue.
This may be counterintuitive, but Republicans have also been, at least in terms of specific charities. I remember I asked Al Gore, I said, how come Dick Cheney gave so much more money than you did? And we went into that a little bit of a tango on that. But it in many cases, it happens to be just a fact.
Yes, but let's focus on the churches. Because although in their private lives and internal activities, the churches over the last 30 years have been working hard on trying to solve individual cases of poverty, this has not been at the top of the public agenda, the political agenda of churches. They've been focused publicly and politically on many other issues. But now, and the summit at Georgetown that you referred to is a very good example of this, increasing numbers of church leaders, especially from the evangelical and Catholic communities, are focusing on this problem, the problem of youth poverty. And the most notable example, he's not alone, but he certainly is the most powerfully eloquent, is Pope Francis. I think Pope Francis is actually helping drive a change in the political climate in this country, certainly among Catholics, but also among religious people of all denominations. So I really do think that getting the big battalions of religious voters to pressure their leaders to work on this problem will be an important achievement.
Again, we're spending this hour with Robert Putnam, and his new book is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Let me open up the phone lines. Do you think the American dream is dead? And what are your thoughts, really? What are your feelings about this gulf that's opened up even greater between poor kids and rich kids, especially where opportunities are concerned, less equality of opportunity, and maybe even the collapse in some ways of social mobility in the working class? Let's hear from you. Our toll-free number is yours. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are spending the hour with Robert Putnam, who had the bestseller Bowling Alone. He has a new bestseller. It's called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. He's also a professor of public policy at Harvard. And we are inviting your involvement in this program, really talking about the gap between the rich and the poor in this country, but particularly in terms of opportunity for children. I mean, there's always been, you know, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer and all that sort of thing. I remember as a freshman taking a course in American history and reading Michael Harrington's The Other America, which opened up my eyes. But we also fortunately read The Affluent Society by John Kenneth Galbraith. And you realize how extraordinary that gap has always been. But now we're talking about the American dream as a possible fulfillment that is available to the children of all different classes and has become, to a great extent, Bob Putnam's book shows, maybe less to a dramatic extent, less available to those who are more impoverished. Let me go right to your calls here. And by the way, you can join us also by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Or if you have questions or comments and you want them to be part of this conversation, go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Let me bring a caller on from Menlo Park. Henry, good morning.
Thank you, Michael. Robert Reich of Berkeley and numerous others advocate and describe what's called a universal basic income policy, whether a negative income tax or some other form, wherein everyone, every citizen or, you know, permanent resident would be able to get some sort of break-even income, assuming certain conditions, that would be significantly higher than the earned income tax credit. And this sort of thing has seemed to me for years to be the best sort of across-the-board policy suggestion for this sort of broad social problem, good night and moon time for parents who struggle for work and so forth. So I'd like to know the guest's opinion of that.
Yeah, Robert Putnam.
Thanks very much, Henry. Well, there's no doubt that if we could somehow get more income and more job opportunities available to what we used to call the working class, that would have a powerful effect on the problem I'm talking about. So I agree that with the basic premise of your call, whether the right way to do it is the specific way that Bob Reich has suggested, which is a plausible idea. But there are other ways too. We could imagine getting increased income and, I repeat, job opportunities, which are important as well, to low-income people. And
housing plays a great role here, too, where you live.
Absolutely.
Obviously.
It does. And, you know, that, Michael, the housing part of this is really important because one of the other things that's changed over the course of really our lifetime is not just there's a growing gap in the income levels between rich people and poor people, but that increasingly we are living in segregated places. That is, increasingly rich folks are living in rich enclaves and poor folks living in poor enclaves. Again, Sean Reardon at Stanford has shown this.
Work, yeah.
And what that means is, it's not, by the way, it's not just we're living in different places. We're less likely to go to school with kids from a different class background. When I was growing up, all the rich kids and poor kids were in the same school. That's no longer true, and that's partly why there's the growing gap in the school quality that kids face. But it's even true with respect to intermarriage. We're more likely nowadays to marry people of a different religion than we used to be. We're more likely to marry people of a different race than we used to be. But we're less likely to marry people of a different different class than we used to. And what that reflects is that people in their marriageable years are less likely to encounter someone from a different class background. So we're moving toward what is disturbingly like, you know, an apartheid society. I don't mean apartheid in the sense of racial and...
No, you mean two Americas, really.
Exactly. I do mean that. And that has powerful implications for all that we're talking about here. And it means that you can imagine America, this is what really worries me, honestly, Michael. An America unlike anything we've ever seen before. There have been class differences, of course, but an America in which we're two different castes in America, the privileged group, which wouldn't happen to include me and my kids, and the less privileged group, and hereditary. That's the part that just is so contrary to American core values.
It's also, I hate to bring this up in a way, because we thought we had ameliorated the digital divide, but we really haven't to a great degree. I mean, sure, poor kids have access to computers at their schools and so forth, but there's still a great digital divide. And there's also, and certainly has also contributed probably to employment problems and all of that, but it's also what you call a savvy gap.
Yeah. The gap in access, in physical access to technology has actually closed a lot since over the last 20 years. So even the poorest kids that we talk to have cell phones and have smartphones. But what the evidence shows is that rich kids and poor kids use the technology in different ways, that rich kids are more likely – I mean, kids coming from educated, affluent homes are more likely to use a technology in ways that enhances their prospects for upward mobility, and poor kids
don't.
That's
the digital divide.
Exactly. And that is exactly due to what you referred to, which is the savvy gap, the fact that – remember, poor kids nowadays are increasingly isolated from everybody. They don't have – they basically have very, very few responsible adults or mentors in their lives, unlike kids in affluent homes, my grandchildren, who have lots of adults who are helping them out. And that's great. I think it's wonderful. But that means that the poor kids don't have somebody to explain to them how to use the cell phone to get access to jobs, for example, instead of just using it for pure entertainment. So that isolation and the resultant savvy gap plays into many things, like the way the kids either are able or are not able to use technology.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me go to a caller up north in Santa Rosa. Damien, join us. Damien, you're on.
Hey, how's it going? I just want to say spoken famously by George Carlin, they call it the American dream because we have to be asleep to believe it. We live in a capitalistic society, and in a capitalistic society, as you both know, there's going to always be a rich and a poor. And America, just like the gentleman just said, is increasingly becoming more of a two-tier society. In a capitalistic society, we know that it is very important for the masses to be uneducated, because if the masses are uneducated, they can be taken advantage of more. And then when you think of a period back in time in the United States, like back in the 60s, where people from all types of backgrounds had access to like a Berkeley education, where, you know, they were going, you can get a Berkeley education for $30, $40, $50 a unit. And you had people coming out of there organizing groups and politicizing and changing things. Now the only people that have access to that education are the elites, who are eventually graduating from there and then becoming the politicians and pretty much keeping the status quo in place. With this whole setup, the increasingness of people being put into prison has all been put by design, because if you look at how the influx of prisons that have been built in the United States, it's appalling. And the reason that they're being built is because they know that a large portion of the United States population is not having quality access to education. And if you don't have quality access to education, then you're going to be subject to poverty. If you're subject to poverty, then you're more likely to commit a criminal crime. So this is all by design, and I think that what he's talking about is somewhat of a pipe dream, because the way that our society is designed is that it's only the margins are only getting wider. The gap is only getting wider. The disparaging differences are only getting greater, and there's really nothing that is affirmatively being done.
But Damien, you're suggesting there are kind of chess players behind this, that everything is orchestrated, aren't you?
Oh, there's definitely. I mean, there's definitely chess players behind this thing. We could talk about some of the chess players who are behind some of these things. But I don't want to start naming these names, because as soon as you start talking about some of these names, people automatically throw up their hands like, okay, this guy's crazy. So, I mean, for those who know, they know. There are definitely chess players who are definitely wielding this game. And I mean, unlike a Monopoly game where everybody starts off with the same amount of resources, the same amount of income, the Monopoly game that we are placed in the United States, unfortunately, is an uneven Monopoly game. Everybody doesn't start off with the same resources.
Well, Damien, let me thank you for the call and go to Bob Putnam on this. There are a lot of people who do see this as being orchestrated, I suppose, but the reality is there used to be what was called the Horatio Alger dream. You know, is it the warp and woof of America? Is it a pipe dream now? That's what he's kind of saying. Really.
Well, actually, let's begin by saying that a lot of what Damien says is absolutely right. It's true that this amazing expansion of imprisonment and it's hit us very
it's big money.
That has an effect on what I'm talking about, because it has pulled large numbers of men and fathers, dads, out of communities for nonviolent crimes, and so that's a part of this story. And Damien is right that the fact that states across the country, and especially in this state, have disinvested in higher education has had exactly the effects he's talked about, which is making it harder for poor kids to get into top quality state schools. But the part that I disagree about is that this has always been true in America, and there's never been any difference, any periods of greater upward mobility, greater chances for people coming from the bottom, because if you go back to the reform that I talked about before, that the turn of the century, about 100 years ago now, when people began to be focused on this question, and lots of decent people said, we can't go forward in this way in which there are these enormous yawning gaps between the opportunities open to rich people and poor people. And we did something about it by creating free public high schools, first in the world. America simultaneously did two things. We boosted the whole economy because the increase in the quality of the education of our workforce meant that we were the dominant economy in the world, largely because of the amount of human capital that we had. That's what the economic historians say, that that decision to have universal secondary education first in the world contributed essentially to the growth of the American economy in the 20th century, and at the same time, it did level the playing field and did offer objectively more opportunities for people to rise from poorer backgrounds. So I agree with Damien that the current situation is pretty dire. That's the point of my book. But I disagree with him. There's nothing we can do about it. I think there are, in the past, we have done, I'm not suggesting we should become Sweden. I'm suggesting we should just do what we have done in the past in this country, which is to focus on the fact that we're all in this together.
I'm reminded by a listener named Ben that we had a guest on. I don't know if you know this book, author of a book called The Sun Also Rises, S-O-N. And it was Gregory Clark, who's a professor at UC Davis.
Right.
And Ben writes, his research has shown that social mobility has been basically exactly the same throughout the world for centuries. It seems that moving up is a great fantasy that is perpetuated by the rich who want to feel good about themselves. Everybody's altruism stops at their wallet. I was struck by that book. We had the author on, as I said, because so many cultures do have this lack of social mobility when you factor in and look at the equation of heredity and you look at those who are of the upper class to begin with or privileged to begin with. It goes on generation after generation. And those who do not have, the have-nots, goes on generation after generation.
Well, you know, it's like viewing landscape from 30,000 feet or closer up. If you're looking at the world from 30,000 feet, it looks like there's inheritance of social status and of economic well-being universally across time and across space. And at the level of 30,000 feet, something is true about that. But when you get closer to the facts, it's not true that all countries have the same amount of upward mobility. America has in the past had relatively high upward mobility compared to other countries. And it's not true that it's constant over time. It just isn't true that it's constant over time. There are increases and decreases in upward mobility depending upon the degree to which the society decides to provide more equal opportunity for kids that would otherwise be on the
Well, there's even something more disturbing, though, about that book. Social policies, he concluded, don't seem to have much impact.
Well,
Sweden was as immobile as the United States.
I'm sorry. That's not what the evidence says now.
We should get you two on together.
We should, yeah.
But here's I want to get to some more callers and more listener comments. Lots coming in. Here's a Facebook comment from Aaron who says, a number of economists, including Nobel laureate James Heckman, and business leaders are focused on investing in early childhood programs as the key to shrinking the opportunity gap. Has Dr. Putnam looked at early childhood policies and whether investing there does, in fact, hold great promise?
Yes, that's an excellent question, Aaron. The last chapter of my book, and we haven't talked much about it, is a longish list of things that we know would work to narrow the gap. And top of my list would actually be exactly as you say, universal early childhood education. We know from hard evidence that high quality early childhood education makes an enormous difference. We know that from case studies and from real experiments all across the country. It's not cheap. It's not enough just to have babysitters. And so low cost, cheap early childhood education turns out not to have any effect. But high quality early childhood education conducted by professionally paid teachers turns out to make an enormous difference, especially for kids coming from poor backgrounds. And therefore, even though the upfront costs are high, and this is what Heckman has showed, the long-term payoffs in terms of the greater productivity of kids who've gotten that early boost dramatically more than makes up from the high cost. So that's the best single thing. There are a lot of other things we need to do too, but that's my nominee for the 21st century equivalent of the universal high school, which was the 20th century reform that had such powerful effects.
Do you know there are people who are calling you Obama's Piketty? You haven't heard that?
I have heard people talking about that, yeah.
All right, we're going to get some more callers on here. Can you say something a little bit offbeat here, but Rick Santorum, you actually publicly tendered an apology to him.
Yeah, I did. Senator Santorum has been going around the country.
Not generating much of a crowd, by the way. He had one person in Iowa recently.
Well, he's been quoting my book as saying that the permissiveness of the 60s has caused low-income men to be sexual predators. And that's what he's been saying, and it's just not true. And he doesn't provide any evidence. He doesn't cite. The data that he presents doesn't appear in my book. And so I called him out, but I misquoted exactly what he said. I quoted him as having said that black men are sexual predators because of the permissiveness of the 60s. And that was not literally what he said. And as soon as I realized that I had misstated his comment, I publicly apologized to him and because I misstated him. I'm still waiting for his apology for having repeatedly misused my book.
Don't hold your breath, Bob. Let me bring another caller on here. And thank you for waiting. We got a caller from Georgia. Veda, hi, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I would like to speak to what the two of you gentlemen were talking about in your own discussion about civic responsibility. Now, I'm speaking as a teacher of 13 years and someone who is about to welcome his first child into the world, and just the importance of education and, you know, this time at night that you're referring to with reading. As far as the civic responsibility, though, I would argue that there would be a great number of people in this country who, number one, either have forgotten or don't fully understand their civic responsibility. But number two, when you look at someone such as myself as a teacher in the middle grades who is trying to teach civic responsibility, in the social studies, I've got just a little bit of time throughout the day. The rest of it should be done in partnership at home, and I'm sure you probably allude to this in your book, but a lot of that, you know, partnership or collaboration is not available at home, or, you know, those parents don't have those resources. And I certainly don't want to belabor the problem, would much rather look for a solution. But then I go to me in my personal life with wanting to focus on raising my son to be successful. Where does that time, where do those resources come from to invest in other children? Certainly don't want to say their children or those children, but I would say that the main focus should be our family. Thank you for taking my call.
All right. Thank you for your comments. And
thanks very much, Veda, and I appreciate much of what you said. First of all, I applaud your work as a teacher and the work that you're doing to help kids get a sense of civic responsibility. And I agree with you, actually, and do talk about this in the book, that there are important parts of the story that I'm telling that involve parenting, and good and bad parenting, and that we need to – and we actually – there are programs, there are parenting coaching programs that have been proven to have a good effect, that is helping parents learn more about what they can do to help their own kids advance. But I do want to say something about the responsibility of the rest of us, because one of the things that's happened over these last 30 years is that we've privatized and pushed onto families responsibilities that used to be all of ours to bear. I'll take a particular example that may sound trivial, but actually is quite important. There's a growing gap in participation in extracurricular activities, band and football and chorus and French club and so on. Growing class gap in the sense that rich kids are participating as much, if not more than ever, in those groups, but participation by poor kids is plummeting in all of those extracurricular activities. That's really important because we know that from lots of research, that extracurricular activities teach soft skills. That is, kids learn teamwork, they learn delayed gratification, they learn grit, and they learn other character traits.
Also help you get into better schools.
And in fact, what we know is that people who've taken part in extracurricular activities earn more over their lifetime compared to people of the same IQ and test scores. They earn more because employers are willing to pay for those skills. But now, for the first two-thirds of the 20th century, everybody in America going to any public school was able to take part in extracurricular activities. That's why extracurricular activities were invented at the turn of the century 100 years ago, and to enable all kids to get access to these activities that were so valuable. But beginning about 20 years ago, 30 years ago, in California and across the country, we've instituted pay-to-play. So that now if you are a kid and you want to play football in high school, or you want to be in the band, or you want to be in the French club, your parents have to pay for that. And the inevitable effect is poor kids are dropping out of these activities. That's an example of where by privatizing that, putting that responsibility back onto parents. Well, rich parents can afford to pay. It costs, on average, for two kids to play in two sports all, across the year, costs $1,600 for parents. Now, if your annual income is $200,000, $1,600 is nothing. But if your annual income is $16,000, who in their right mind is able to spend 10% of their total family annual income on extracurricular activities? That's a case in which the rest of us have disengaged from our responsibilities to make sure that there is a level playing field, that all kids have access to these opportunities to learn, and not just rich kids.
Again, our guest is Robert Putnam, and his book is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Let me get another caller on. That's you, Anya. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking the call. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the education concept. I was lucky enough to sort of come to America and live in a very poor area, and really my family had no money. My parents ended up having to work two jobs. We never saw them. Food stamps, low-income housing, the whole thing. But somehow things really worked out with, you know, both kids Ivy League educated and successful. And I think part of it was really having a kind of grit and really working hard early on and understanding that sort of the only way out of the poverty situation that we are in was really education. And part of that was, you know, somehow we got lucky in getting full scholarships at Catholic schools, and that really helped because we could do certain things that maybe we wouldn't have been able to do. We couldn't participate in any extracurricular activities or anything like that because, honestly, the moment we could work, which was at like 10 and 11, we were working. But still, somehow, over time, that has worked out. And so I sometimes wonder now, when there is this big gap, what was different in my life that allowed me to sort of move way past that? And why can't other kids be able to do that?
Oh, yeah, that's an excellent question. What makes it different with grit now than it was with grit moving ahead in her day?
Well, I applaud Lanya's success and her siblings' success. Of course, I don't know the whole story. I just know what she was able to share with us briefly here. But I think there are two parts to what she's already told us that help me understand why she was able to succeed. In addition, of course, to her own talents and grit.
But values matters. Had a lot to do with it, didn't
yeah,
it?
But here's the values that I think are relevant. And the source of those values in her story, first of all, she had two parents. They were working hard, but they... Having two parents who are devoted to their kids, she didn't, I think she said that she comes from an immigrant background, and we know from the evidence that in the first generation, immigrant parents are likely to be, first of all, both of them in the family, stably in the family, and supportive of their kids. Even if the parents are having to work hard, they're supportive of their kids' aspirations and pushing them forward in productive ways. And secondly, she had the good fortune to go to Catholic schools, and we know that Catholic schools serving the poor, on average, do a better job of enabling those kids to rise. Nobody knows quite why it is that Catholic schools have those better results with poor kids than other schools, but the, part of the evidence suggests that it has to do with the values that imbue those schools. I'm not a Catholic, so I'm not.
One of my Catholic friends says it's because the nuns didn't spare the rod, but I don't know if that's the. Anya, what do you think about what Professor Putnam said? Would you agree?
I mean, I do agree, but it's hard to compare because I didn't go to a public school. I only ended up going to a Catholic school. I think having really good teachers who cared was great. I spoke no English, and within 3 months was fully integrated into a normal curriculum, primarily because everyone in that classroom helped. And I think kids today coming probably don't have that opportunity. But you know, it wasn't just that. It was a lot of tough work and decisions that were made throughout our early years and as teenagers. And, you know, we ended up getting scholarships to go to college because, of course, my parents had no money to do that. And then things just progressed from there.
Well, let me congratulate you on your success. I think it's it's a wonderful story because I think as Bob was pointing out, it's clear that your parents had a kind of value system that played no small role in your success and ongoing success to you. Thank you for calling us. Let me bring another caller in here who's joining us from Iowa. Sue, you're on. Hi.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
An interesting counterpoint, assimilation here, that I had a similar background to your previous caller. I was born into a poor family, but was very blessed to have parents that made all those sacrifices. And in a community where there was a fair share tuition program, where I was able as well to go through Catholic school all the way through college. And I'm blessed to have a successful life now where I'm able to help support my parents and so forth. My comment also goes back to a previous caller with regard to civic responsibility and what I would deem a social consciousness that I see from the previous centuries in the TR time and ER and FDR times, where today's families seem so disenfranchised that I don't know that parents have the hope that my folks had, that making these sacrifices.
Sue, I'm sorry. Let me jump in here because we got seconds left. I'd like actually to pick up on that thread and quick response from Bob Putnam. Hope and hopelessness. What do you discover?
Hope is obviously an important ingredient in success in life, and we Americans ought to do all we can to make sure that all of our kids have well-founded hopes, not just vague aspirations that, you know, the American dream. That's what we used to do in this country. We used to provide for reasonable hopes for all of our kids, and we the country as a whole benefited from that, and I'm just trying to bring us back to that tradition.
Well, good luck in that mission, and thank you so much. Good to have you back on Forum with us. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.